Hey, if you're enjoying this show, consider supporting us on our Patreon. You can get cool perks like access to these episodes a week before they go public, and you can pick an album for us to review. Any support is greatly appreciated, so if you feel inclined, go to patreon.com/polyphonicpress.
You're listening to Polyphonic Press, a podcast for music lovers. Join your hosts, Jeremy Boyd and John Van Dyke, as they take a deep dive into a classic album and analyze it track by track.
Hey, welcome to Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
I'm John Van Dyke.
And let's not waste any time. Let's get right into what we're
doing this week.
I'm going to share. And here we go. Let's click the button.
Ooh,
Dave Brubeck Quartet, Time Out. I don't know the Dave Brubeck Quartet. I've honestly never heard of them.
I have.
You have?
Classic jazz. You know the song Take Five?
Maybe.
In fact, it might even be on this album.
It might be on that album. Okay, cool. Yeah, I can get into some jazz. I'm not that familiar with jazz.
Well, it's not what I primarily listen to too, but I've certainly heard enough of it and I like it. And I'm into hearing the whole album. I might have actually heard it all.
There is I know the standards. I know like Miles Davis Kind of Blue. Actually, I think that's the only jazz album that I'm familiar with. So Time Out is a studio album by the American jazz group, the Dave Brubeck Quartet, released in 1959 on Columbia Records, recorded at Columbia's 30th Street Studio in New York City. It is based upon the use of time signatures that were unusual for jazz, such as 9-8, 6-4, and 5-4. Interesting.
Yep.
Okay.
Which is where the track title Take Five comes from.
Oh, okay.
It's a 5-4 time.
Yeah, Take Five is on here. Okay.
Yep.
Okay, so the first song on the album is called Blue Rondo a la Turk. Cool. All right, so let's hear it. Okay, that was interesting. I like the way that it started out really intense, and then I like the slow transition to the more easy laid back part. Because it was a bit of a jolt going into that part, and then they went back to the intense part, but each time they went back to the intense part, it was less intense. I thought that was really fascinating.
Yeah, and you can tell that the intense part is a completely different time signature, a really unusual one. Bum, 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 sort of the thing going in. And then, of course, it just sort of like slowly morphs into this like nice sort of a laid-back jazz thing where everybody gets their turn to sort of shine. And you hear that bass line going through it, the stand-up.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that... Well, first of all, it's amazing that this was recorded in 1959 because it sounds like sonically it's amazing.
Oh, I've noticed that about a lot of jazz albums. It's like a lot of jazz stuff that came out in the 50s sounds like it could have been recorded yesterday.
Yeah.
It's just really, really, really high quality. I don't know exactly how they managed to do it back then, but they were miles ahead of what pop was doing at the time. It would take them another 15, 20 years to catch up. In that sound department.
Do you think maybe it's because, with pop music, they just wanted a quick product to get it out right away, and they didn't spend enough as much time mixing and doing
that. To a certain degree, yes, but it's almost like the studios they were working in. There's a lot of like classic, and this is not to like cut it up. I actually really like the sound of like a lo-fi sort of a old fashioned recording technique. In many cases, I feel like I would really like to actually recreate it in a lot of cases, but there's a lot of classic, producers and stuff from that time period who really knew what they were doing, but it's almost like the jazz, producers were just that extra meticulous, or I don't know what kind of equipment they were using. Like, where did they find microphones that could do? I guess, you know, the SM58 was out, so, you know.
Yeah.
That was the, it's the industry standard to this day, and it's called the SM58 because it was invented in 1958.
Mm-hmm. It was invented in 58, but I don't know how common it would have been in recording at that time.
Yeah, it wasn't yet. You would notice even like on stage, you would see like almost any other type of microphone still being used on stage as late as the 60s and even into the early 70s. But you know, you go to any stage setup nowadays, what do they have on stage?
They've got usually a 58.
Some format of a 58.
Yep.
So yeah.
And the other thing that I noticed was, it's amazing that obviously it's a quartet. So you have the drummer, bassist, piano, and saxophone. And it's amazing with those four instruments how much the sound is filled up.
Yeah.
Like there's not a whole lot of space.
Yeah. I mean, there is space into what they're playing, but yeah, it fills. If the sound spectrum was like a jar, there's not a lot of, you know, obvious gaps in the jar where you think, well, something could have at least tumbled into that area. But no, it actually does fill it out. There's nothing. Yeah, there's no obvious, there's space, but there's no obvious gaps.
Yeah.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and the playing on it was amazing. I wonder how many, who is actually playing on this? I know Dave Brubeck is playing piano. Dave Brubeck, Paul Desmond on alto sax, Eugene Wright on bass, and Joe Morello on drums. I don't know who any of those guys are, but they're great.
Yep. They're members of the I almost said the Dave Clark Five. No. The Dave Brubeck Quartet.
Yeah.
Little bit different
there. Yeah, just a tad. Just a tad. All right, so let's hear the second one called Strange Meadow Lark. So the interesting thing about that is, or at least the intro with the piano, it sounded a bit more like a classical thing than than jazz. It's not something you think of when you think of jazz. You don't. So that was a bit of a surprise to me.
Jazz does borrow a lot from classical, especially stuff like this. A lot of a lot of freeform jazz and stuff like that take sort of the rules of classical and with like a blues structure and then breaks those rules, which is a lot of what goes on with a lot of jazz musicians are classically trained.
Yeah.
And it's that thing where I've said before, it's like, learn the rules before you break them.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what they did. These guys are like really, really, really like, they know their shit.
Oh yeah.
when it comes to like music theory and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And they know how to break the rules and not, you know, chase people out of the bar. Unless, of course, they're actually trying to clear the room, which they would have a tendency to do, right, where they would literally get up on stage and play just whatever,
yep,
to get anybody who's not a jazz fan to like leave before they start actually playing the stuff that they're going to play.
Right.
Yeah. They actually did this.
That's amazing.
Yes.
It's like, if you're not going to appreciate this, get the hell out of here.
Basically.
Yeah.
But instead of saying it, they just, you know, play a bunch of crazy stuff.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So this album is actually, it's a bit of an experiment. And so this is on Wikipedia. So the album was intended as an experiment using musical styles that Brubeck discovered abroad while on a United States Department of State sponsored tour of Eurasia, such as when he observed in Turkey a group of street musicians performing a traditional Turkish folk song that was played in 9/8 time with subdivisions of 2+2+2+3, a rare meter for Western music. On the condition that Brubeck's group first record a conventional album of traditional songs, where did I see it? So this was,
yeah, that's the way it usually goes.
Yeah, that was the record company doing that. But this album actually did better than that one. It was peaked at number 2 on the Billboard charts and was the first jazz album to sell 1 million copies.
Well, there you go. It's just, before we're gonna let you like dick around with like weird, you know, whoopie doopy stuff and whatever, we're gonna make you do straightforward stuff first, because that's what's gonna sell. Meanwhile, this is the one everybody remembers.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm sure the other one isn't bad, but it's just,
no, I'm sure it isn't bad, but yeah. But it's funny.
That's just, you know, times have changed in a lot of ways, but in a lot of ways they haven't. Record companies still have that same mindset of, well, let's go with the one that's safe, and then,
except they won't give you the option of doing something safe. To, you know, they don't say, here, you do this, we'll let you do what you want to do if you do this first.
Right.
They just straight up want you to do what they want you
to do. Don't not deviate from that.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you do so much as deviate from it, they consider that like, you know, a betrayal of some sort.
Yeah.
It's kind of messed up.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And it happens all the time with every artist. Like, I don't think there's any artist that is not at one point in their career had a problem with their record company. I can't think of a single artist that I've read about or heard about that is not had a problem with their record company. Like,
yeah, I know. Maybe some of those like straight up pop artists that towed the line and became like part of the industry themselves or something, but for the most part, yeah, everybody's got some sort of story of them butting heads with the boys upstairs. Mm-hmm. So
it's just Because they care about,
They're putting out a product, and the artist is putting out art.
And
that's what they're trying to do.
I get it to a certain extent. Like, you're paying for this album to be made, and you want, mm-hmm, you know, your return on your investment. But
you'll get a better return, certainly a more lasting return, if you let the artist have a little more control, though.
Yeah.
And that's been proven time and time again. This is a prime example.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. So let's move on to the next one. This is the song that you know, called Take, mm-hmm, 5. So here we go. Cool. I honestly had never heard that before.
You've never heard that?
Never heard that before.
That was quite a big hit for them, that song. It's been in a lot of movies and stuff like that too.
Yeah. So. I probably have heard it, like if it's been in movies, but I've never been aware of it, I guess.
Yeah, okay.
I guess that's I'm in the minority there, because it's actually, I was just reading about it as we were listening. It's the biggest selling jazz single of all time.
Yeah.
So
that doesn't surprise me at all.
I thought it was cool. The, I guess this must be where it gets its title from, but it's in 5/4 time, which gives it this sort of bounce feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought that was really cool, and I thought it was cool that usually when there's a drum solo in a song, all the instruments kind of drop out, and you let the drummer do what they're going to do. But
about half the instruments dropped it.
Yeah, but this one, it's like there was still a little bit of piano just to kind of push the drums along. It was sort of like the drummer and the piano switched roles, where it's like, the drummer's keeping time, and then once the drummer is off going to do his solo, then it's the piano's job to keep the time.
Yeah. The piano is keeping the 5/4 going.
Exactly.
Especially if the song's not going through your head, which if you've heard the song several times before, like it seems like easy because you know how the song goes. But at the time, the song is... It's 5/4 timing, and nothing else came out that sounded like this, at least on Western radio.
Right.
So it wouldn't have been a natural, well, maybe for jazz musicians, it may be a little easier than for the rest of us plebs, but, you know, it's not a natural, like, instinct to try and play a solo over a 5/4 timing.
Right.
So to have something, you got to have something, even for the drummer, the piano going on would help it keep, you know, where they are in the drum and the drum solo. And you don't get to hear the drum solo very often, even when you hear it in other places, it's always the main riff. The drum solo itself is very, I wouldn't say random, it's obviously meticulous, but it's,
spontaneous.
It's got a very spontaneous feel to it, and trying to keep a 5/4 timing going through your head while you're playing, boom, boom, and you're playing stuff like that, and
easy to get
you're
lost.
Playing like exactly, so having that piano going along would actually help, and plus it actually fits. So you know the song didn't suffer for it at all,
right?
But even didn't the bass drop out?
Yeah, it was just the piano playing, and you could barely hear the piano.
Yeah, well, it was just sort of like bopping along in the back there, just underneath. Yeah,
but I do wonder, like how much, like what we know about jazz is these guys would improvise a lot. So I do wonder how much of this was planned out and how much of it was improvised.
Well, what I mean by okay, it probably wasn't written, it was probably very definitely improvised, but it wasn't it comes from a place of knowledge. It wasn't just hitting drums for the sake of whacking a drum. It was they know what they're doing in their head.
Yeah,
but they would still need to know where they were in the bar for to do it correctly and to have it to come off, and having the piano play it would definitely help with that.
Yeah, but I wonder like if there was a discussion of okay, you're gonna you're going to do the drum solo, and when you're doing your drum solo, I'll keep time on the piano. Or if it just kind of came up spontaneously, you know?
That's hard to say. I think they probably kind of knew what they were doing for that, or maybe they just did several different takes, or they tried different things.
That's possible.
Maybe the fifth take. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how many takes they actually did. But anyway, who knows how many times they tried different things and picked the one that, you know, well, it's got the piano going, which is all right, but it's the one that we they think turned out the best. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that was part of the decision. You kind of have to ask them.
Yeah. All right, well, I guess we'll move on to the next one. The next song is called Three to Get Ready.
Here we go. Is it maybe in 3/4 timing?
By the sound of the title, I'm gonna bet $1 million, maybe.
All right.
Yeah. All right. Cool. That had almost like a, I don't know what you would call it. Like, I get visions of, like a Southern, like New Orleans kind of feel with that one.
Hmm. Interesting. I heard a little bit of like European folk song in it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and it was in 3/4 time, or at least parts of it were.
Yeah.
It sort of jumped between, you know, 3/4 timing and then sort of like a 4/4 jazz sort of swing thing.
Yeah, it kind of just kept switching back and forth.
Yeah.
No, I thought it was interesting. And again, it's, I'm just still marveled at the quality of, the recording in this.
Mm-hmm.
I know I've said it before, but it doesn't sound like 1959.
No, I know. The thing is, yeah, you listen to Miles Davis stuff from this period, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
It just sounds like it could have been recorded yesterday.
Yeah. And I'm sure this, we're listening to a remastered version that,
even like
this been cleaned
really,
up.
Even when it first came out, like, I mean, you could play it on a record and it would still sound sort of like it's on a record, but you can definitely tell that the recording quality was just top notch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and late 50s, early 60s jazz stuff, nothing sounded better at that time than the jazz stuff at that time.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't really have anything more to say about that.
we'll just move on
to the next one. So this is called Kathy's Waltz. There's a great use of counterpoint in that.
Yeah.
Where the drums are kind of driving and doing this consistent shuffle sort of thing with the brushes, and the piano's kind of playing the opposite of that, almost. Yeah. And I thought that was really clever.
It was funny, when the track started, it was just like, okay, it's not a waltz.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it went into a waltz after a little bit.
Right.
It did take a bit, but it did get there.
It just kind
of
fell into
all the
into
songs
it.
On this track, this doesn't sound like a waltz.
Yeah. I was reading about this track, and I don't really hear it, but maybe you do. I was trying to figure it out, but I couldn't really hear it. There, apparently, Paul McCartney lifted the melody for All My Loving from this, and I don't really hear it.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of it, and I can't really hear it yet either. I guess he heard something in there. It must have been something somebody played in the middle of it or something.
Yeah.
The sax solo, or...
Well, it said, I don't know. What is it? Said, in an article for The Independent, Spencer Lee speculated that Kathy's waltz inspired the song All My Lovin', written by Paul McCartney and performed by the Beatles, as they share similar rhythmic endings to the last phrases of their melodies. I don't really hear it. I
think I hear maybe a little bit more of the... Yeah, it might just be like that part of it.
Yeah. I can't... How does...
The end phrase part. Like the... Not the... Oh, my lovin'. It'd be the...
Then all my lovin' to you. That part?
Yeah, it might be something like that.
Okay. I still don't really hear it. I think I
might be able to hear it a little. I don't know. It's not like...
It's a bit of a stretch.
Straight up clear to me. Maybe. Maybe he got inspiration or something, but... Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't jump out to me.
No.
And sometimes these things really do jump out to me. That one didn't jump out to
me. No, it's not like Noel Gallagher ripping off T-Rex like we talked about last week.
Yeah, a little more straightforward, yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So the next song that we've got is called Everybody's Jumpin'. Cool. I've never heard a drum solo played with brushes before.
Oh, I have.
That was...
For sure.
Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, they sound really good with brushes. They did sound amazing, actually. Yeah, it always gives a very different sort of feel. It is a... Just by using brushes, you can play like Ginger Baker, and it just sounds more laid back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I really liked... I liked how the first track that we listened to really filled out the space. Mm-hmm. And this one left a lot of space. But I didn't feel like anything was missing.
No, again, nothing. They don't, again, there's no gaps left in anywhere in this album, but there's definitely a sense of roominess without sounding empty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's almost like they, like the first track is they're filling the space and they're in a large space. Yeah. Whereas this one is they're still filling the space, but the space is smaller.
Yeah. It is almost like you can visualize the size of the studio they're playing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's just like that's just playing with dynamics and
yeah, absolutely
knowing when to pull back and when to push a little bit. And I mean, I don't want to be one of those guys that that says that people in like the 50s or jazz musicians are better than wherever, but a lot of rock musicians don't know when to pull back, and I think that's a lost skill.
It's a certain discipline that a lot of jazz musicians hold themselves to and each other to that you don't generally get with. I mean, rock musicians can be very hard on each other for sure, but yeah. It's the criticisms, they're a little less. I don't know. It's just a very different discipline. And I know lots of musicians who are, you know, have jazz backgrounds and stuff like that. And you can tell that they know things that you would never hear coming out. I mean, and this is not to put down like, you know, rock or pop or folk or any other genre of musician. And I know tons of them too. But... You know, take for example, like Jimi Hendrix and play the hell out of a guitar, but apparently he could never read music.
No.
So, but jazz musicians, they do.
Yeah.
They can read music. they're not going to get very far if they can't.
Right.
They know their theory. They know their stuff like this. I mean, I guess you can sort of like do... Like, if I was going to play jazz, it would be all on feel and instinct and stuff like that. You put a piece of music to me, I might be able to sit there and sort of figure out the gist of what you're trying to do, but it's most of it looks like Egyptian hieroglyphs to me. I kind of get, you know, when you see notes in notations, it's like, well, what's going up here? I gotta sit here and actually count. Every good boy deserves favor. And figuring most of the, okay, that's a B. It'll take me like a month to get through a line of notation.
Right.
Most jazz musicians can read it like they're reading a sentence. Like,
you
just know exactly where it's going. They can read it in real time.
Yeah. I'm always amazed. But the thing that I respect about jazz musicians more than classical musicians is classical musicians, a lot of the time, I feel they get very set in being able to read music, and they
lose the whole feel thing. It becomes very technical.
Right,
yes.
Exactly.
I know.
Whereas jazz, it's sort of like, yeah, they can read the music and they know the theory.
They got the best of both worlds.
Exactly. They can be spontaneous and they know what they're doing. They know the theory behind it. So that kind of frees them up to be able to explore different avenues. Whereas maybe rock musicians are limited by the fact that a lot of them, not everyone, but a lot of them don't know how to read music. So it's sort of like jazz musicians are like kind of right down the middle. It's like they're in, you, like you said, best of both worlds.
Mm-hmm. And this is also not to cut up classical musicians either, because I mean, if you go to like a classical, I've seen lots of like very passionate classical performances who have had a lot of feel behind and stuff like too. But yeah, and generally when you look at an orchestra, it's like the feeling is being conveyed through the conductor.
Right.
Whereas the musicians are, they're doing their part, but it's the conductor that's sort of like controlling kind of like the volume.
Right.
In a way, or just the feeling, and sometimes the energy is being presented through just his movements and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But if you're a really good classical musician, you can read the conductor really well and you know exactly what he's doing.
Right.
So there's like, it's like a different way of getting that feeling across. Mm-hmm. in that sort of a setting. Anyway,
yeah.
I'll let you continue.
Well, I was just going to say, like, classical music, a lot of it is written and it's planned out and it's very strict and
it's
meticulous.
Very methodical.
Exactly. Whereas
absolutely,
jazz is, it can be. Like, there's, if you go to school for jazz, you're going to have to play the standards and a lot of that. But there's also a lot of improvisation, and there's a it's a little more loose than just... sight reading and playing what's written on the page.
Yeah. But again, in classical, you can still bring a certain feel to it. But yeah, what the music that's actually being played is very definitely very rigid. You don't want to mess up a note doing that. At least not anything really noticeable.
Exactly. Yeah, you don't want everybody to be on F and you're playing C, you know, or something like
conductor.
That. So we got one song left, and the last song is called Pick Up Sticks.
I like how that was, it's 6-4 timing, but it's played like it was, like a 4-4 or an 8-4. More like an 8-4 with two bars chopped off. And it was just kind of, it works. I mean, it's totally 6-4 timing, but it's just like, it's like a full four bars and then just two of the boom, boom. And you can really hear it in the bass line. It's just really cool. That bass line was wicked.
That was, yeah. It was a great way to end the album too. Everybody kind of had their own, everybody got a chance to shine on that one, I think.
Yeah.
It was a perfect ending to the album. So yeah, I really enjoyed this album.
Classic jazz from this era. This really is the golden era of jazz.
Yeah.
I think, well, actually, a lot of people consider like the 30s and the 40s. And there's a lot of good stuff from there, to be perfectly honest. That was when it was really, jazz is being sort of little overshadowed by rock and roll at this point.
Yeah.
But I would still say that a lot of the golden stuff is coming out of this point.
Yeah.
So.
I would say, well, I don't know. I'm going to have to listen to more jazz, but
yeah,
of the stuff that I know, the 50s is probably maybe my favorite era of jazz.
Certainly had the cleanest recording quality,
yeah,
as we were already talking about it. Although it never like dropped in quality from there.
No.
But it's like they were 21st century quality in 1950s and they never had to improve much.
I know. I can't get over how clean it sounds.
I know.
It's just amazing. Amazing that they... I'm curious, where was this recorded? It was recorded at Columbia 30th Street Studio, New York City. That doesn't surprise me that it was recorded in New York. Yeah, it was recorded in... So there was a lot of albums recorded in this studio.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Miles Davis, Kind of Blue.
Yeah.
The soundtrack to West Side Story. Chicago's first album, Chicago Transit Authority.
Okay, that sounds... Yeah, okay.
And it's also where Pink Floyd's The Wall was recorded.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Or
at least part of it. I don't know if the whole album was recorded there.
Certainly the stuff that was recorded there in the 50s. It's that studio that really kind of has that sound. I don't know. Maybe it's kind of like Sound City in Van Nuys, where the room just has a certain sound to it or something like that, where it was just really, really I don't want to say like a dead room, but it has to be somewhat dead to get that clean. There's like a real presence.
Yeah.
Everything recorded in there has got this real presence to it. If you're gonna put any like reverb on it, I think you kind of have to like doctor it in.
Yeah.
Unless there's another room that echoes more,
well,
the bathroom or something. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it really could be like a big studio with an open space, but mm-hmm. it just, for whatever reason, the shape of it or the material that's on the walls just gives it that huge, or not huge sound, but
presence.
That presence, yeah. And
a dry sort of presence.
Yeah. But I mean, I know this, and I know you know this, is when you're recording, the room makes a big difference.
Yeah, it does.
Especially when you're recording drums. An album like this, also, where all of the instruments are acoustic, the room makes a huge difference. And
absolutely.
So it might just be... But also, this is Columbia Records, and Columbia is are they not known to be like a high quality like jazz record company?
No, I would imagine so. They certainly were at this point. So yeah, Columbia. It's not like a lot of like there's Blue Note Records. Columbia is known for being a little bit more diverse in the stuff they put out. There's Blue Note and Verve, which were known as primarily jazz labels.
Mm-hmm.
Columbia clearly has, you know, some classic jazz stuff on it. We're just listening to one. So,
well, and the other thing too is this album was recorded in 2 days.
That's impressive.
So, well, I think a lot of it, two separate dates, July the early July of 59 and then mid-August of 59. So there's two separate dates. So I wonder if because they... I don't mean to say that jazz is easy, but recording jazz doesn't take as much time because all you really have to do is set up the microphones and let the musicians play. So I wonder if because recording jazz is pretty quick that they only had two dates to record this. I wonder if going into that, they knew that they only had to book a little bit of studio time so that they could save money on that and put more money into the quality of the recording.
Well, again, it comes down, I think it comes down mostly to, you know, the discipline of the musicians, like they're consummate professionals.
Yeah, but I'm just talking about the sonic quality of it. And
The sonic quality, it might be.
But I'm just saying, like, because they knew that they only had to, they didn't need a 3 months to record the record. They could do it in two different days. Because they didn't have to book as much studio time, I wonder if more effort was put into the quality of the recording and not, they didn't worry so much about taking up studio time.
Possibly. I guess they recorded maybe a few takes off the floor and picked the best one and then basically just put all the effort into, at least production, put all the effort into, getting it as good as possible.
Yeah.
They clearly don't have to doctor the performance any. I mean, they just didn't at this time period anyway. But
no, there would have been a little bit of mixing, but you know,
that's about it.
Yeah,
yeah,
and even
basically just putting deciding how much of which instrument you want to hear in, and this would have been mono recording too.
Yeah,
I believe so.
Well, you know, it is in stereo because
this is in stereo. Yeah. Okay, 59. Okay.
But I wonder, like, I just wonder how many tracks that they're using, because it can't be more than four tracks. Because I don't think they had more than four tracks.
Not in general. I mean, yeah, I think even the most advanced studios at this time were still basically four tracks.
Yeah. So that's, if it's a quartet, so you have one track per instrument.
Yeah, it makes it real easy.
So,
but I'm also thinking, like, if you think back to like stuff going on at Sun Records and the other rock and roll records being produced at this time in the late 50s, I don't think they labored so much over that stuff either. You didn't get to that stuff until, you know, you get drug-addled musicians in the 60s who had really weird ideas, and then they really had
that's
to
true. Yeah,
well, that's, take up a whole lot more tracks on a board.
That's actually a point I made earlier, that they, you know, that they, at this time, they wanted pop music to just get it done and get out. Yeah, that's true. It must be just the quality of the studio, because Sun Records, it has its charm, but it's not a great studio. Historically, it's not a great room to record in.
It's a basement it was a storefront.
Right.
Yeah.
So it might just be that they're in a great space. I mean, that must be also, Columbia Records has their
money.
So they have
money to throw at the room.
Yeah. And they have, this is their studio. So they have probably the latest equipment at the time.
Yeah.
So, but I'm still amazed that it was 1959.
Yeah.
Like it just doesn't sound like it.
Yeah. I've gotten sort of used to the idea, but yeah, the first time I listened to a really clean jazz thing, and I thought it was like a recent recording, and then I looked at the thing and it said like 1961 on it, and I'm like, what the hell?
Yeah.
And this was like, I don't know, maybe a couple of decades ago when I first, I know what it was. It was oh, there's a CD kicking around. It's all, Cole Porter stuff.
Okay.
And one of the tracks on it is this, like, I think it's a jazz vocal group, but the production sound on it is, like, again, just as pristine as this. Mm-hmm. And then I looked at when it was recorded, and it was, like, really early 60s, and I was blown away. And then I found out that, actually, this was pretty standard for late 50s, early 60s recording quality at this time period.
Yeah.
And, it's since just become one of those facts that I'm aware of. But, yes, it is very mind-blowing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so, I don't know, I need to listen to more jazz, I think. I think that's what my takeaway from listening to this, because I really like it, and I didn't realize how much I like it. So, yeah, that's my takeaway. I really enjoyed this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, ace, quality.
Yeah.
A plus.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, that's all I have to say. Do you have anything else you want to say?
I think I pretty much got out all my ideas, I think. Okay. I think I blathered on.
All right. All right, well, that's everything. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
And I'm John Van Dyke.
Take it easy.
You have been listening to Polyphonic Press. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Polyphonic Press. Check out the website, polyphonicpress.com. Feel free to drop us a line at polyphonicpressmusic@gmail.com. And finally, you can support the show by heading over to patreon.com/polyphonicpress.